You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Following months of rumors and anticipation, Hillary Clinton finally announced on Sunday that she's running for president in 2016. In Is Hillary Clinton Any Good at Running for President?, his cover story for New York Magazine, contributing editor Jason Zingerle gives us an analysis of her real chances of winning in light of past campaign missteps, a tenuous relationship with the press, and the fallout from a recent revelation that she used a personal email server while heading the State Department. The article appears in the April 6th issue of New York Magazine. I'm very pleased it's brought Jason Zingerle to our show. You write that, barring something truly unprecedented and totally unforeseen, Hillary Clinton will become her party's nominee in July 2016. Is it because there are just no other strong candidates in the party?
Yeah, that's part of it. There are no other strong candidates, and there are more than that. There are no candidates who want to challenge her. I mean, you know, I think we'll get into this a little bit later, you know, her talents or lack thereof as a politician. But one thing she is fantastic at is the inside game. And her, you know, dominance in the Democratic Party right now is a testament to her skill at, you know, working with Democratic elites and making them comfortable with her and sort of making it impossible for anyone else to really mount a serious challenge against her this time around in 2016.
She has big leads in the early polls. National polling data called on Real Clear Politics shows an average of 59.8% for Hillary compared to 11.5% for Joe Biden, 4.3% for Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, there's just no one who's even in the same ballpark with her. I mean, there are people who will say, you know, well, she was inevitable in 2008, and look what happened then. But it's a different kind of inevitability right now. You know, in 2008, Obama and Edwards were polling a lot higher than Biden or, you know, Bernie Sanders or Martin O'Malley or anyone like that. I mean, they were still well behind her, but not behind her to the degree that people are today. She really is truly inevitable this time when it comes to the Democratic nomination.
Despite that, you refer to her as an abominable candidate. What do you base that on, and how does that work with the polls?
I mean, she can be an abominable candidate, I think, and I think that's sort of the great question hanging over 2016. I mean, she is not a natural politician. If you look at her career and her runs for elected office, she has not performed that spectacular in any of her campaigns. I mean, she won two of them, obviously, the 2000 Senate race and the 2006 Senate race, and then she lost in 2008. But even the ones she won, you know, the things that we sort of think about as, you know, the attributes of good politicians, you know, very good speeches, good on a rope line, you know, have a certain amount of charisma, you know, people who are extroverted, who really kind of crave the sort of the human interaction on the campaign trail, those are not necessarily things that she, you know, has. I mean, she suffers in comparison to her husband and to Barack Obama. But even if you weren't comparing her to those people, they're still not necessarily her defining traits. So she has to kind of overcome, I think, her own sort of natural personality, her own reticence, her own kind of reluctance to put herself out there, which, you know, I think is kind of hard-earned. I mean, she certainly experienced the downsides of that during her time in the White House. And those are all things that, you know, come into play during a campaign. And I think, you know, while she has been very good at clearing the field for 2016 in the Democratic Party, she won't have that advantage when it comes to a general election. She's going to have a Republican opponent, and it's going to be a different kind of ballgame at that point.
You quote a number of unnamed political operatives talking about her ability as a campaigner. Why not give their names?
Well, I gave the Republicans names because Republicans, for the most part, I think most of the Republicans in that piece are named, maybe one or two aren't. They don't have qualms about having their names associated with negative things about Hillary. But, you know, the Democratic Party, since she's the only game in town, Democratic operatives are not as comfortable giving their names because they're going to have to deal with her at some point. So that's why they requested anonymity and, you know, to get them to talk candidly, I gave it to them.
Well, what about running on her record as a senator or her work as Secretary of State? Does that affect how good a candidate she'll be?
Yeah, sure. And, you know, she has a good record as a senator that I think will, you know, help her. You know, I think her time as Secretary of State is a bit more muddied now. I think, you know, I think when she left the State Department, I think she and the people around her, you know, assumed that was going to be a centerpiece of her campaign, her time at Foggy Bottom. But in the years since, her record there doesn't appear as glowing as it once was. I mean, you know, you look at sort of the Russia reset, you look at, you know, what's happened in Libya, and I'm not even talking about Benghazi, but and I think Benghazi is probably just a distraction, but just, you know, there are the Obama foreign policy successes are not as great as people once thought they were, and obviously she's going to be associated with those. And then, of course, there's the email situation as well, which, you know, looms over a lot of things right now.
Although Jeb Bush also has an email situation, and he is right now considered the likely Republican candidate, it seems like every candidate has embarrassing things that come up during a campaign at one point or another. But will have an actual bearing on Hillary's campaign, or the way she handles the fallout? Is the way she handles the fallout more important?
I think it's probably the way she handles the fallout. I mean, it's two things. I mean, will they actually have a bearing on her campaign? I mean, and this is something that, you know, I try to get into in the story a good amount about, and it has to deal with sort of political scientists and how they view these things. And, you know, if you talk to sort of political scientists who look at these races, I mean, they say that the media's fixation on these gaffes and the like is really, you know, ridiculous, given that voters don't really care about it. I mean, for the most part, voters aren't paying sufficient attention to actually know what the gaffes are. So they really are not going to have an impact on the race. I mean, even if you go back to sort of the gaffes that are most memorable, like, say, in 2012, Romney's 47% comment, there's a political scientist at George Washington named John Sides, and he has a colleague out at UCLA named Lynn Vavrick, and they wrote a really fantastic book called The Gamble, which analyzed the 2012 race. And they said that even the 47% comment, you know, they looked at sort of the polling before and after, and basically there were people, Romney supporters, who moved away from Romney after that comment. They then became undecided. But then as soon as Romney did well in that first debate, they came back to Romney. So even something as significant as that, you know, which dominated the headlines, which became, you know, a staple of Obama's media strategy, was featured in attack ads, that didn't penetrate. So in one respect, yeah, the gaffes are not as significant as those in the press make them out to be. On the other hand, though, and this is something that I think will be, you know, potentially a problem for Clinton, the media's criticism of her and their questions, like, it can create kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? The reporters focus so much on you know, these questions about her honesty and her integrity, that at a certain point that actually does start to show up in public opinion. And, you know, I think the cautionary tale for her in that respect is what happened to Al Gore in 2000, when he had a series of, you know, small misstatements, missteps that the press just seized on and fixated on in the final months of the campaign. And you actually saw that reflected in public opinion polling, where even among Democrats, fewer and fewer found him to be trustworthy. So it really did kind of become a self-fulfilling prophecy, and it actually did damage him at the polling place.
Do about nothing like the Whitewater controversy. On the other hand, we don't hear much about her tarmac claims. And you described some of her worst gaffes in recent years being, telling Diane Sawyer during an interview that she and Bill were dead broke when they left the White House. Well, beyond the fact that that may not have much of an impact, how close to the truth was that?
You know, I think it was literally true, in the sense that they had really substantial legal debts after they left the White House. And I think that, in a way, she was very frustrated that, you know, the literal truth of that statement was being questioned. But at the same time, you know, someone who's pulling down these, you know, multi-million dollar speaking fees, just using that language, I think, was problematic for her. And certainly it's something that, you know, her Republican opponent is going to use against her. I mean, you already see Republicans using it against her now. I was talking to one Republican for this story, and he said that they had actually conducted focus groups on that interview in, I think, Colorado and Ohio. And this person was actually surprised how just how negatively people responded to that comment. I think he had thought going into the focus groups, this is just kind of a media story, it's going to go away. But then talking to these, you know, middle-income women, female voters, they reacted so viscerally to the line that I think Republicans view this as something that they're going to be able to resurrect and use against her. And, you know, I think you'll see it probably in campaign ads, and it'll be something that she has to deal with and try to explain away. And, you know, that's something that she is not always that good at. Making a mistake and then recovering from it. Sometimes she compounds the error by not recovering quickly enough. And that certainly happened in the original instance of this. You know, she said it to Diane Sawyer, and then she gave a couple other subsequent interviews where she tried to justify it before finally she said, you know, I shouldn't have said that. And I think it's that process that gives Democrats some pause about her and makes them a little concerned that, you know, she's going to do this to herself again. It's a self-inflicted wound.
Is a high public speaking fee unique for someone of her stature? She gets $200,000. Rudy Giuliani reportedly charges $270,000 per speech. Larry Summers charges around $135,000. He was never Secretary of State, and he was never First Lady.
It's not. No. Look, she's charging the market rate. I think it becomes a question of perception. And why is, you know, she was going to run for president. It was fairly clear she was going to do this. Why was she accepting paid speaking fees right up until the time she announced, or almost up until the time? Again, there's nothing, you know, she's not charging more than the market will pay her. But I think the question, you know, about it is, you know, just in terms of how does it look to voters? How can it be used against you? Do you really want to give them the ammunition?
What was wrong with the way she handled the press conference at the United Nations following the email revelation?
You know, I think a press conference like that, you want to leave it with there being fewer questions than you went into it. And, you know, it was a kind of appearance where she actually created more questions. It didn't put an end to the question. It only opened up more doors. And she, you know, it just was not a good appearance for her. I mean, part of it was just the way she looked, the way she acted. She seemed tensed. She seemed, you know, you could tell she was uncomfortable. You could tell she was kind of testy at points. So there's just kind of the atmospherics. But then, more significantly, it didn't end the matter. It didn't close the matter. It didn't clear anything up, really. It just led to more questions. And I think that was one of the bigger problems.
Will she also be hit by things that really are more Bill's domain, like the millions donated to the Clinton Foundation by foreign governments?
Yeah, no, I think the Clinton Foundation is going to be something that her opponents are going to spend a lot of time mucking around in and trying to dig up dirt. And I don't know if that's necessarily more Bill's domain or not. I mean, it's you know, she has her name on the foundation now. So it's just another area where her opponents are going to look for, you know, damaging information about her.
What does political scientist Alan Abramowitz's election model argue are the fundamental factors in a presidential election?
It's called the time for a change model, and it you know, if you look at how well it's predicted races, it really is kind of phenomenal. Abramowitz focuses on three things. He focuses on the economy, and, you know, whether it's growing, and the specific thing that he looks at is GDP growth in the second quarter of an election year.
Well, she isn't hurt by that right now.
No, and she hopefully, you know, for her sake, she hopefully won't be. I mean, the economy does appear to be growing, and it, you know, assuming it continues in that direction, that'll help her come 2016. The approval rating of the incumbent president, and, you know, what that is in June or July of election year, and that also looks like it will be working in her favor. You know, Obama's numbers are going up, and he might be getting closer to 50 by the time of that rolls around next year, you know, assuming nothing dramatic happens between now and then. And then there's this third factor, which is the number of years a party has been in the White House. And Abramowitz thinks, and, you know, his model shows that if a first term, it's really difficult for a one-term incumbent to lose. He thinks it's actually almost a four-point advantage to run as a one-term incumbent. So, you know, Obama had a four-point advantage in 2012. You know, Reagan had that, Clinton had that, but George W. Bush had that. The difficulty becomes
Jimmy Carter didn't have it.
Jimmy Carter didn't have it. He's the cautionary tale. But af- after that one term, it becomes harder because voters do want a change. So that's going to be, you know, that's going to be something that that Clinton has to deal with in 2016. Are voters going to be tired of having a Democrat in the White House? And will that be enough to offset the, you know, advantages she'll presumably have from, you know, recovering economy and a relatively popular Obama?
You have referred to the 2008 election as the campaign, as a soap opera. The campaign as a soap opera. Will 2016 be any different?
No, I don't. I think it will. Yeah, because I think I think 2008 was a soap opera in the respect, in terms of how political junkies viewed it. You know, they saw it as this great narrative, and it had fantastic, you know, kind of larger than life characters in Obama and Clinton and Palin and McCain. And if you think about the way it was covered in that respect. And certainly the books that came out of it, if you think of Game Change as, you know, the definitive book of 2008, and it reflected that view. And then in 2012, the sort of predominant analytical lens was all about the polls, and, you know, Nate Silver in a way was the biggest character of the 2012 election. He was kind of, you know, Clinton, Obama, and Palin all rolled into one for 2012. The main players, Romney and Obama, kind of shrunk, and this is in terms of how political junkies viewed it. And now in 2016, I think, you know, the people who really follow this closely, a lot of them are looking to people like John Sides at George Washington and, you know, Brendan Nyhan at Dartmouth and people like that, these academics who write about it, and they're trying to view it through the election through their lenses. And I think in that respect, it will be more of a kind of academic lens that, you know, political junkies view the race through this time around. There'll be more talk about the Time for a Change model. Alan Abramowitz's name will be part of the conversation in a way that it wasn't, say, in 2008 or 2012.
But you're right that in terms of analytical innovations and polling data, nothing really matters unless it does.
Yes. Well, that's kind of that we sort of come full circle. I mean, you have the Sides of the world and the Abramowitzes and people like that who say, you know, you really do have to focus on the fundamentals. But then there's sort of the caveat that if the fundamentals all kind of balance, you know, all kind of cancel each other out, then you actually do come back to the question of candidate quality and, you know, debate performances and speaking skills and conventions and things like that. And in a really close race, maybe that does become definitive. And then the question becomes, okay, but which quality becomes definitive? What's most important? And you just sort of chase your tail a little bit as you go through this stuff.
Jason Zingerle's article, "Is Hillary Clinton Any Good at Running for President?" is the cover story of the April 6th issue of New York Magazine. We'll continue our conversation after this. We're back with Jason Zingerle, whose story, "Is Hillary Clinton Any Good at Running for President?" was the cover story for the April 6th edition of New York Magazine. Do we know, Jason, what's motivating her to run for president again? In her announcement tweet on Sunday, she wrote, "I'm running for president. Everyday Americans need a champion, and I want to be that champion." That's a kind of an empty statement, isn't it?
Yeah, she has not, you know, sort of stated the most robust rationale yet for her candidacy. I mean, you know, that's something I'm sure she'll do.
Well, Andy Berowitz joked that that she ran a little campaign thing on the internet that was only kittens.
Yeah, I saw that. I mean, even, you know, even if you take the joke away, it really, I think someone was saying they thought it looked like a State Farm ad, mm-hmm. or, you know, and there were people who clicked on the ad and thought it was a paid media thing. You know, it was an actual, you know, ad for something else before her announcement. It did have a very kind of soft quality. You know, I think yesterday she started to flesh things out a little bit, talking about campaign finance reform and things like that. And I'm sure she will in the coming days. I mean, the thing that's been sort of most striking so far is how she's really kind of tried to portray herself as an economic populist, and you see that in her comment about everyday Americans. But, you know, she's literally taking language from Elizabeth Warren in terms of the deck being stacked against, you know, middle class Americans and the like. And, you know, I think she's trying to remake herself in some ways as this populist, which is, you know, where the Democratic Party certainly is these days. And so it's not surprising she would do that. But it'll be interesting to watch her and how effectively she can actually portray herself along those lines.
She's viewed as more hawkish than other Democrats, in part because of her vote on the Iraq War and her stance on Iran as when she was a senator. Has that alienated her from the liberals in her party who should theoretically be her allies? I'm thinking about the fact that Bill de Blasio has not yet come out in support of her.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably given liberals some pause about her, but not in a serious enough way that there is, there's an alternative for her. I think in part it's because foreign policy isn't quite as salient in 2016 as it was in 2008. I mean, her Iraq vote in 2008, without that, Barack Obama never gets any traction. I mean, that was the biggest argument against her. It's just not as front and center this time around, foreign policy. The foreign policy differences within the party aren't as central to the race itself. So, yes, I think there's some concern about that. There's some disagreement, but it's not significant enough to actually, pose a serious threat to her. I mean, I think that if there was going to be something that posed a threat to her, it would be more domestic. It would be something like, economic policy and her ties to Wall Street and the like. And I think that's why you've seen her take these steps to kind of insulate herself from that charge. Because if a candidate who was running against her was going to get traction against her, it would probably be on something like that.
Well, I'm sure she's heard about all the people who want Elizabeth Warren to run, although Elizabeth Warren said she's not. You say she struggled to exhibit the basic qualities required of politicians during her two successful campaigns for Senate and her unsuccessful presidential bid in 2008. In what way?
Just out on the trail, in terms of dealing with reporters, dealing with voters, dealing with the unscripted moments, looking like you're enjoying yourself. I mean, she's caught in a bit of a catch-22. She's caught in a very big catch-22. I mean, I think naturally she is, a somewhat introverted person. I think she is reluctant to, even if she were extroverted, I think she'd be reluctant to put herself out there given what she's been through. So, that's kind of her authentic self. And yet, reporters and voters want to see, the authentic politician, and that's kind of who she is, but she can't sort of necessarily show them that. And I think she herself is kind of flummoxed by this demand for authenticity. I think she finds it kind of frivolous and stupid, and she said as much in certain moments. I think there was a press conference in 2000 where she I don't even remember what she was asked, but it led to this really kind of revealing answer where she just complained about reporters saying, who are you really? And this focus on authenticity and wanting public figures to reveal that about themselves. And she was saying she really thought that wasn't important. Unfortunately, reporters do think that's important, and they're going to keep on trying to get that out of her. And it's not necessarily what she wants to show, or even if it is who she is, it's not what they want to see in her. So in that respect, it is kind of what she struggles with in the out on the hustings, out on the campaign. I mean, when she's in a different environment, when she was in the Senate, she actually had very good relationships with the reporters who covered her because it was a different kind of a relationship. They were focused on legislation. They were focused on policy. They were focused on the substance of her job. The same thing happened when she was at the State Department. She had, very good relationships with the Foggy Bottom Press Corps. They were all on a small plane together going around the world. She'd end a lot of her days at the hotel bar with them at off-the-record drinks. Because when they were talking to her, they wanted to talk about Burma and, other sort of foreign policy things, substantive things. Unfortunately, that's not necessarily what campaign reporters want to talk about. And I think there's just a little bit of an oil and water quality there. And she's the one who ends up suffering from it.
Jason Zengerle wrote the cover story for the April 6th edition of New York Magazine, Is Hillary Clinton Any Good at Running for President? This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Some political scientists and consultants argue that being a good candidate is overrated. If she can earn her party's nomination, doesn't that prove she's playing in the same league as her opponent? And didn't political scientist David Carroll tell you, demographics, the economy, and war and peace are more important than whether someone has a nice smile or is a good debater?
He did tell me that, and I think that's, it's a very important point that at this level, basically, you're not going to get a lot of difference between candidates in terms of their actual qualities. If you were to go into down ballot races and House races, you'll see campaigns where the Democratic nominee is, that much better than the Republican nominee or vice versa. But when it comes to the presidential campaigns, just to win your party's nomination, you have to clear a certain bar, and it's a relatively high bar, and she will clear it, as will whoever wins the Republican nomination. And that at the end of the day, she has strengths and weaknesses, but so will the Republican nominee, and they're going to cancel each other out. And in the end, that's when these political scientists come back to the fundamentals. And you know, the analogy that Sides and Vavrick uses is a tug of war. That you know, the press likes to look at these presidential campaigns like they're a boxing match, you know, with wild swings of momentum and a knockout punch can come at any second.
But they love the narrative. It's been said.
Yeah, they love the narrative, and you know, it has to be a thrilling narrative. But you know, in reality, what the campaign is actually like is it's like a tug of war, where both sides basically, you know, playing each other to a stalemate, which is very, very, you know, inch gains one way or the other. And in the end, what tips the balance is something that's, you know, out of their control and out of the consultants' control, and that has to do with the economy and approval rating for the incumbent and War and Peace and things like that.
Pat Buchanan, the former advisor to Nixon and Reagan, said, told you that she reminds him of Nixon. But didn't he love Nixon? Does that mean he's going to support Hillary?
It was. I think in some ways it was a backhanded compliment. I think that remark from someone other than Pat Buchanan might have been entirely negative. I think there was a bit of a grudging admiration for her, more just in her you know, the fact that this isn't natural for her, it's not necessarily, you know, what she is naturally good at, and she has to overcome that, and she kind of grinds it out. I mean, you know, I think the other comparison he made was he was talking about Obama and Clinton and JFK as, you know, being akin to Mickey Mantle or Roy Hobbs from The Natural, you know, and Hillary is more like Pete Rose. I mean, Pete Rose is, you know, but for the gambling, he'd be in the Hall of Fame. It's not a terrible comparison, but, you know, Pete Rose hit singles and he had to hustle. He was Charlie Hustle, and I think that's kind of what he sees in Clinton, this effort. She doesn't make it look easy, the same way Nixon didn't make it look easy either, and I think that's kind of what he was getting at.
You're right that in the past, Hillary Clinton has resisted making gender-based appeals. However, in an afterword to her memoir, Hard Choices, which was published on the Huffington Post last Friday, she wrote at length about her new role as a grandmother. Is she expected to reverse the gender-neutral strategy this time around?
Yeah, I think she is. I think her gender is going to be a centerpiece of her campaign. It was something she really, you know, tried to avoid in 2008. She wanted to downplay it.
And why? And after all, there were a lot of women who felt simply it was time for there to be a woman president, and she was the woman in the race.
Yeah, but I think they were concerned about making her look strong, you know, and there was this focus on Margaret Thatcher, who obviously never played up her gender, and that was the model that Mark Penn, who was her pollster in 2008, encouraged her to follow. You know, this time I think one of the big reasons she's doing it is because, you know, a major challenge she's going to face is turnout. I mean, one thing that Obama was able to do was he was able to create this coalition of, you know, young voters, African-American voters, Latinos, and get them out to the polls in unprecedented numbers. And there is a concern among Democrats that the Obama turnout machine, the Obama coalition, can't come together without Obama at the center of it. So how do you recreate that? And one area where they think they might have an advantage is with female voters or people who just want there to be a historic first, a trailblazer, a first female president. And that's going to be something that, you know, Hillary will emphasize in order to get people excited about her candidacy and actually go to the polls. So I think you will see this focus on gender as a way to try to gin up excitement, because in order for her to match Obama's turnout, she's going to have to get that excitement level up. And if she's not able to necessarily do that with her speeches or with her personality, you know, running as a trailblazer, running as a first is another route to that same end. And I think you'll see her do that this time.
She has problems with the press. Don't her likely opponents have problems with the press? Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, Marco Rubio, who have already announced, Jeb Bush, who's likely to announce, also Scott Walker, and even possibly Chris Christie, who may no longer be a viable candidate.
I don't think they have problems with the press the way Clinton has problems with the press. I
mean, aren't they all pretty much painted as being slightly crazy?
No, I don't think so. I think you see Cruz painted in that light sometimes, and, you know, maybe Rand Paul sometimes, but I don't think the press paints Bush or Rubio or Christie is crazy. I think, you know, they might have other adjectives for them, but crazy I don't think is one I would apply to them.
Well, not Chris Christie. Chris Christie has other kinds of issues.
Yes. Crazy is not one of them, though.
And Jeb Bush has problems within his own party.
Yeah. Yes, Jeb Bush has problems within his own party. I don't think the press is going to be his problem yet. I think, you know, he has more concerns about grassroots activists and conservative activists than the press. You know, I think Ted Cruz has bigger concerns probably with the Republican establishment than he does about the press. I think, you know, in Hillary's case, part of it's because, you know, she doesn't have any concerns within her own party. There isn't another candidate. She's basically running against herself, and in that respect, you know, the press becomes her opponent. But I also think, in addition to that, there is just this very long history at this point between the press and Hillary Clinton and the whole Clinton family. And there's a lot of, it's, you know, it's just a very dysfunctional relationship. There's a lot of sort of suspicion and, you know, dislike on both sides. You know, the problem for Hillary, though, is that she bears the fallout for it. She's the one who suffers in the end. So she, therefore, the onus is kind of on her to figure out a way to make the situation better. Because without that, she could really, you know, be harmed by it.
She announced recently at a journalism awards dinner in Washington that she wanted a new beginning with reporters.
Yeah, and then she told a, you know, it was actually a pretty funny joke about how there was a non-disclosure agreement underneath the seat. So if you just sign that, then we'll have our new beginning. And yeah, and people laughed at that. And then it was what actually happened after that, though, that was you know, more significant, some people thought. She actually stuck around after the speech. I think she was originally supposed to go and just give the speech and then leave. She wound up staying through the dinner and then even stayed after the dinner and, you know, went out into the crowd and mingled with reporters and schmoozed with reporters. Her campaign staff, I think, is spending a lot of time trying to buttering up is probably the wrong word, but at least have, you know, good relationships with reporters. They've had, you know, these off-the-record dinners in New York and D.C. right before she announced, where they had the people covering her come over. And John had, in D.C., it was at John Podesta's house, who's her campaign chairman, and he made, you know, walnut pesto for them, I think. And I think this is something that, you know, in terms of them looking back on 2008 and what went wrong, I think one of their big lessons was just the really bad relationship her campaign had with the reporters covering her, and they're trying to repair that this time around. I think the question, though, for her is, you know, she can hire all the press-friendly aides she wants. Can she herself get to that point where she feels more comfortable around reporters, isn't as, you know, sort of paranoid about them and just, you know, uncomfortable around them?
Is it going to be an effort to recreate the vaunted Obama machine, as you call it?
There is, you know, and that's, I think, in several ways. I mean, she's hired a lot of the Obama campaign's top people. You know, her ad maker is Jim Margolis, who did ads for Obama. Her pollster is Joel Benenson, who is Obama's pollster. I think she's probably going to hire a lot of the people from Obama's field operations. So there is, you know, they're bringing on board a lot of those people. And in some ways, though, that's just where the Democratic Party is these days. I mean, the Democratic Party has adopted all of the Obama campaign's tactics and practices, so it's only natural that she would do it too.
We have a listener. We have to make this quick because we've run out of time. But Sherry from Patterson asks on our show page, can you ask your guest about when Hillary went negative on Obama at the end of her primary campaign, or that she kept running despite not being able to mathematically win the election?
Well, that was something that, you know, I think really people forget how bitter things were between Obama and Clinton in 2008. I think the years since then, when she actually worked for him, have kind of papered over the antipathy. But yeah, the Obama people were, you know, they really resented her, you know, some of the ads she ran, the 3 a.m. phone call ad, you know, some things that Bill said. I think, you know, when Obama won the South Carolina primary, he made some disparaging remarks about it, about, you know, any African-American winning that. And then her insistence on running when it did seem like it was going to be mathematically impossible. So there, you know, there was a lot of ill will towards her among the Obama people, and I think we do forget that. And you see some of that resurface now, although for the most part, most of the Obama people are on board with her now. I think that was one thing she did a very good job of in the years since, especially, you know, when she was working at Secretary of State. And this is something that, you know, people who are observing her think will serve her well in a presidential campaign. She was able to win over the Obama people. I mean, one person I talked to, Tommy Vitor, who was an Obama staffer, said, you know, she won over people who were literally, you know, a year before had been paid to destroy her. She was able to charm them, get them to like her, get them on her team. He sees that her ability to do that will serve her well when she's at a diner in New Hampshire and is trying to convince, you know, a mother there that she'd be a good president. So she does have those skills. know, the question is she going to be able to deploy them in such a way during a campaign that they work?
Jason Zingerle's article, Is Hillary Clinton Any Good at Running for President?, is in the April 6th issue of New York Magazine. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.